Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to a look back on the year that was the Kelly Alexander Show. We were so fortunate to have so many great guests in 2013, and on this episode, you'll hear from the amazing Serena Ryder, not to mention personal identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. We also check in with our social media expert Patrick Charles, talking about streaming concerts, and then we wrap things up with Dr. Ed Lamadrid talking about the awesome benefits of acupuncture. All of us at the Kelly Alexander Show wish you a very happy new year and all the best for 2014.
Capture your need for sound.
It's a great thrill to welcome to the show an amazing Canadian talent whose career is skyrocketing with her fantastic album Harmony, which features awesome songs like Stompa and What I Wouldn't Do. Serena Ryder, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Yay, Kelly Alexander Show. So excited.
I'm very happy to have you here. And here's the thing. Now, you've been a musician since you were, you know, fairly young. Did you always know that a career in music was your path in life?
Yeah, I did, actually. Regardless of, you know, the amount of success that I would have or not, I was hooked on music from a very, very young age. And I knew that that's where my heart was. That's where my passion was. And I would be doing it for the rest of my life.
Now, from what I understand, you play a bunch of different instruments. Which one calls to you the most?
My favorite, which I'm okay at, not really great at, but my very, very favorite is the drums.
Nice.
I love it. I feel like it's so much fun. It's so primal. I feel like a little kid when I'm playing them. Very exciting.
Is it true?
One day.
Is it true you play the clarinet?
I did play the clarinet. I played it in high school.
Oh,
and
that's
still, like, I rented one a couple months ago.
And
I actually can still play it.
That's
pretty badly.
If we speak about your album Harmony, to me it's something, and obviously to all of your fans, it's something very special. Did you know at the time of recording it that you were onto something? Like, did you feel magic in the studio going on?
I did, yeah. There was definitely something that was magic in the air when we were writing the songs and when we were in the studio, and it was just so much fun to write and to record, and you could feel it in the air. You didn't know what it was, but you could feel that there was something different about this record from my other records, and there were a lot of different factors that came into harmony
nice.
to be able to record this record. But I think a huge part of it was recording it, you know, at my home in Toronto and in my own studio in my backyard.
Did you record also in Los Angeles? And what is the difference between recording in Toronto, like hometown, as opposed to being in LA?
Very different, you know. But we started, the very first song we recorded was Stompa, because it was the first song we wrote for the record. And that was recorded in LA. And then we came back to Toronto and did the rest of the record in Toronto. And then we did some of the bonus tracks in LA as well. So we did two more. We did three altogether out of 15 tracks in LA. And yeah, it's totally different. I feel like the environment that you're in is always affects the music that you play. But at the same time, it was all very laid back and all very mellow. It wasn't like a big empty studio setting at all for this record. It was really, really chill. And it was always just me and one, you know, producer Jared Batiste, or it was just me and John Levine. So it was really, really kind of a tight-knit, very chill, relaxed setting for the entire record.
Why do you think, for example, that Stompa has touched so many people? Because it has been everywhere. Like, I actually saw it on like a promo ad on BET for like a show called The Game. I was like, look at my girl, she's on BET.
I know, it's so awesome. Well, I know that Stompa is one of those songs that is crossing a lot of, you know, borders musically, genres, and all of those things, because it's a song that has such a positive message, which is really simply and also yet the profoundness of music and how powerful music is, and how, you know, we all have our demons and we all have our lives that can get complicated and complex. But when we have music and when we move around and when we dance and when we use our body and get out of our head, you know, it can be the best medicine in the world. And that's the message of Zomba.
Now, I'm sure this year has been incredibly busy for you with the release of Harmony as well as the success of it. Have you had a chance to enjoy the ride, or is everything a blur right now?
It's been great. It's been really good, you know, and this is something that I've been doing for a while. So I feel like every once in a while, I definitely have to remind myself to just kind of pinch myself and be like, okay, you know, look around, dude. This is pretty awesome. And I do that often. I do stop and I do look around. But, you know, everything, like everything in your life, you know, when you're in the middle of it, it's a bit more difficult to be present. But that's, you know, that's a life goal, to be more present.
Where is your quiet place? Like, where do you get the creative juices flowing? And does it happen because, you know, you're out on the road, you're out doing this, or do you need to really be apart from all of that for a bit to get things happening again?
I find it inside myself. You know, I find it in a lot of different places. But for me, sometimes I will find it outside of myself in the woods or at a cottage, or if I can get by water, be by trees. I find nature really helps me out a lot, helps mm-hmm. kind of center me and fill me up and inspire me.
I also
find it hanging out with kids.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, kids are pretty amazing creatures, you know, and the fact that we all were kids at one point, you know, it's kind of strange to me how we can forget how to be just in the moment.
When I watch you perform, it almost feels like you have like a childhood wonderment to you. Do you like purposely try to keep that with you when you're out doing what you need to be doing?
I try and stay true to how I feel on stage as much as possible and kind of, you know, be there. And I feel like music always helps me kind of stay in the moment. It is. And then I definitely do feel like, you know, a kid when I'm on stage sometimes, because like, wow, like I'm doing what I've always wanted to do, you know, with my life. And when your dreams come true, it's pretty a magical feeling.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Serena Ryder. Make sure you check her out on her website, serenaryder.com. Who would you consider musical influences? And is there an artist out there right now that you would give your right hand to collaborate with?
Okay, well, I have so many musical influences, but I'll give you like a few of the musical influences that were huge on me. Bette Midler was huge growing up. Beaches, that movie, I loved it so much. I love TLC and Janet Jackson.
Nice.
Was massive. The Beatles and Ella Fitzgerald and Etta James.
And artist wise,
for someone, someone to collaborate with, I would love to do a duet with Bruno Mars. I think that would be crazy.
That would be crazy. Let's make that happen, Serena. Let's get on that.
All right. That sounds like a plan.
Now, I just want to ask you about being on tour. Obviously, like, you've got a crazy schedule being on tour. What's your favorite part about being on the road? And also, what does it feel like when you are, you know, performing and you actually see people singing your songs back at you?
Well, you just answered both questions. What's my favorite part of being on tour is when I'm performing on stage and people are singing the words to my songs with me. It's definitely one of the most amazing, magical parts of being a musician, is to know that people have listened to your songs enough to know the words to your songs and sing them back with you. It's amazing. And it's such a celebration. I also love, you know, goofing around with my band, because they're my best friends, and I love hanging out with them and doing crazy, goofy stuff, taking weird Vine videos and tweeting funny pictures. And I like being like a little kid on tour with my band. So that's also a really fun part.
Now, you just mentioned social media. Are you addicted to your social media, your Twitter? Like, I know you follow a lot of people back. You followed me back, which made my day.
I follow everybody back, but they don't allow you to follow more than a certain amount of people a day.
Okay.
So then I get people tweeting me like, you said you'd follow me and you didn't. But I'm like, no, I'm going to follow you. But they stop me from following people at a certain amount. So anyways, I will follow anyone that follows me.
That is fun. And are you addicted to Twitter? Like, do you like really enjoy that personal connection with your fans?
I do. I love it. And I love the interaction, and I love, you know, that I can talk to thousands and thousands of people with one little, you know, tweet. I think it's so cool. I love it.
great. Now, before I let you bounce, what can we expect from Serena Ryder in the next 8 to 12 months?
Oh, my God, world domination. Watch out.
Lady Gaga, look out.
I'm going to have to learn some dance moves.
That's all right. You got some good ones already. Serena Ryder, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Serena Ryder. Again, for more information, check out her website, serenaryder.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
With so much fraud and security breaches happening all over the world, how safe is our personal information? Ever wonder what more you can do to protect yourself from identity theft? Security analyst and author Robert Siciliano joins us to talk about things you can do to protect yourself and what you should be watching out for. Robert, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much.
Robert, when it comes to giving out personal information, where should you be drawing the line?
Great question. And the problem is that we pretty much have to give out our data everywhere in order to get products and services. I mean, you want to buy something online, you got to give out your credit card. You want to get health insurance, you got to give out your Social Security number. You want to apply for a new loan, again, Social Security number. I think what it boils down to is recognizing what the risks are. And when you're put into situations where you have to give up this data, determine if it's worth the risk. For example, if somebody says, if you walk into a hardware store, national chain, and they say, we will give you 10% off everything in the store today if you sign up for instant credit. And so that means you've got to give this guy who's wearing work boots and a ripped T-shirt your Social Security number for 10% off a tool. Now, in that scenario, is that guy going to be responsible with your personal information? I don't think it's worth the 10% off. In other situations where you have, insurance that you have to give to your family, life insurance, health insurance, and so forth, and you're going to give up your social, then, it's worth it. But there are things that you can do, ultimately, to make that data useless to the thief. So recognizing what the risks are, determining, the value proposition, is it worth the risk, and then, again, knowing how to protect yourself.
What's your thoughts on PayPal, Robert? Because I know, a friend of mine, he sort of got me onto that. And he'd had a bad experience, and PayPal, not with PayPal, but with a company, and PayPal actually saved him and helped him out and got his money back.
So I like PayPal. I'm a big fan. I use them quite frequently, actually. They know what they're doing. They have their ducks in a row. They have their security in place. They also have additional measures. So if you're using PayPal from a device that PayPal is not familiar with, they'll send out some type of a notification via email or via text to let you know that there's a transaction taking place, and they might ask you to do something in addition to verify that if you, in fact, are conducting that particular transaction. I do like PayPal. What you have to watch out for is not PayPal itself, but emails that look like they're coming from PayPal that we receive that are designed to get us to cough up our personal information, like our usernames and passwords, and sometimes our credit card numbers. Those are, of course, phishing emails or smishing emails that we might get via text message. So phish, of course, is email, smish is text. And we get them, and it looks like, or it says it's coming from PayPal, but in fact, it's fake, designed to get you to plug in your information. Just be aware of them. PayPal certainly is aware of it, and they will tell you just the same, just to hit delete and maybe even let them know that they received one of these phish or smish communications.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you something. I would say about 6 or 8 months ago, I got an email, one of those phishing emails from someone pretending to be my bank. And right away I knew it was, false or whatever. And I actually reported it to my bank, and they didn't seem to care. Do you hear about that often, where the institution doesn't seem to care?
Yeah, they're so inundated and overwhelmed with fraud. Their brands, your bank, AOL, PayPal, most major credit card companies, and everybody. If you have an online presence, chances are your business and your business's clients have been targeted for fraud using legitimate brand names that we as consumers know, like, and trust. And so if you were targeted, chances are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people were also targeted. So you can imagine the deluge of information that they're getting getting from their clients, their customers, that, you know, this has taken place. And after a while, they're like, yeah, we know. So, yes, it's a good idea to let them know, but chances are they probably already know anyways.
I think a lot of us, you know, sort of live our lives in our own little bubble, and we're a little hokey pokey and don't really always think that there's bad guys in every corner, which is fine on some level, but then others not good. How easy is it for someone to actually clone your Visa or debit card? Because I think a lot of us just like, boop, put it in, give me my money, boop, like do my transaction. They don't think about that stuff.
Yeah, I wish I could live in a bubble all hokey pokey, you know? I just wish that was my life. Unfortunately, I know too much. You know, cloning your card is as easy as burning a CD. For example, you use your card, a credit card, at a gas station, at a restaurant, at an ATM, and when you hand it over or when you swipe it, there's technology readily available that allows a criminal to copy your the information off of the magnetic strip, to clone that card. Whether it's an ATM skimmer or the waiter-waitress gas station attendant has a skimming device by hand, they just simply copy the information off the back of the magnetic strip, and they take it back to their, you know, boiler room operation. They download the data, and they just burn it like burning a CD onto a blank credit or debit card, and then they'll go ahead and make unauthorized charges, either, you know, at a self-checkout or make a withdrawal at an ATM, especially if they've got your PIN code as a result of ATM skimming, which usually involves a skimming device along with a small wireless camera that records your PIN as you type it in. So it's really important to prevent skimming, to cover up the keypad with your other hand as you're punching in your PIN code so that additional camera doesn't see your PIN code. And when it comes to your credit and debit card, just pay very close attention to your statements refuting any unauthorized charges. Generally, by law, within 60 days, I recommend, you know, within one billing cycle, but even going online every couple of weeks to look at your statements.
Can I ask you to, I suppose, either confirm or deny this? Like, I've heard that it's safer if you are using your credit card as opposed to your debit card, like if you are at the gas station, if you are whatever, at a restaurant, for these skimming purposes. Is that true or does it matter?
I confirm. I do not use a debit card out in the wild, meaning that I don't use a debit card like a credit card or like a check card. I don't use a debit card at the grocery store or the gas station. I only use a debit card at my bank branch to make deposits and occasionally to take out cash or to verify me in front of the teller. But I don't use it for everyday transactions. The more you use it, the more at risk it is. And the problem with a debit card is that if it is, in fact, compromised, then the money taken out of the account is actually your cash, which is a problem. Whereas if it's the credit card that's compromised, it's the credit card company's money. And then, you know, money taken out of your bank account via fraud, you end up bouncing checks. Now, here's the thing. By federal law, here in the U.S. at least, we have 60 days to refute unauthorized charges on a credit card. But with a debit card, with a bank card, it's only a couple of days. And I'm pretty sure that it's similar in Canada as well. So that being said, I don't use a debit card because, you know, it's direct access to my bank account. I just use credit and rack up all kinds of points as well.
I'm so glad that you set that straight, Robert, because I think there's a lot of us out there. Like, I've recently switched to mainly doing the credit card thing, and I'm glad that what I have decided to do is actually the thing to do. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show right now, a security analyst and author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity was Stolen, Robert Siciliano. Make sure you check out his website, robertsiciliano.com. Do the PIN codes on, you know, Visas or MasterCards and debits, like, really help, Robert?
The U.S., we just have the magnetic stripe cards, and they're old, antiquated technology, whereas in Mexico and in Canada, everyone's migrating to what's called the EMV, or Euro MasterCard Visa, also known as chip and PIN. And chip and PIN is much, much more secure than the regular magnetic stripe cards in the U.S. So when a PIN is involved, that is in addition to a chip, a computer chip that's built into the card itself, much harder to clone, much harder to copy, and much more secure. Canada and Mexico, they know what they're doing as far as, you know, most of the European nations, they've pretty much all migrated to chip and PIN. And here in the U.S., we're just you know, for whatever reason, 5 years behind everybody else.
Are you surprised by this? Like, I'm surprised that the states are behind. Like, you'd think they'd be leading the charge.
Yeah, you know what it is? It has a lot to do with there are a number of technologies out there that may leapfrog chip and pin. You know, it's been said over and over again that mobile will leapfrog chip and pin, and that we may never go to chip and pin. But, you know, it's become painfully obvious that we're going to have to go chip and pin. You know, the U.S. has been holding out for quite some time, and they've been suffering as a result. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of fraud out there.
I wanted to ask you about this as well. Like, you know, I just recently had to go get my driver license and my health card sort of updated, and so, you know, you're getting your picture taken and signing on that sort of dotted line, which they then burn onto your new identification. Does that photo ID and that signature mean anything, Robert?
Your vulnerable data ultimately is either your social security number or your social insurance number, your credit card information, but even with that, you're paying attention to your statement, refuting it. Your picture is available, it's out there, it's online, it's in social. Your signature is a false sense of security, has no really security value whatsoever. As far as the signature itself goes, it's just scribbly lines on a piece of paper. We've been using it since the days of, you know, kings and queens and kingdoms and moats and dragons and wizards and everything else, and it's a total false sense of security that has no proactive security value whatsoever. So if somebody copies your signature, really in the end, all that does, you know, to a handwriting analysis expert via the bank, is to assign liability when there's loss, and usually it's the bank that'll eat it.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you about this. I actually have a friend that is still in university, and she sent me an email, and at the bottom was her student ID, and I called her on it right away. I was like, why are you sending out emails with your student card number? And she's like, oh, well, one of the professors told us that to communicate we needed to do that. And I was like, are you stupid? I'm like, that's just a gateway for them to get to your personal identity. And so what do you think about university and college kids, you know, just bandying about their student ID number?
So it all depends. Each account that we let out of the bag, right, that we expose publicly, is one more piece of information that the bad guy can use against us. And so, for example, with that student ID, that, you know, somebody who's, you know, nefarious-minded could go ahead and use that to open up, say, certain accounts within the university that might get tagged to the student's account that might involve a credit card or some type of payment that might be required. That may or may not be the case. Every university might be a little different. But that being said, you know, whether it's your credit card, again, Social Security, Social Insurance, student ID, driver's license number, even a phone number for that matter is an account number. Every little bit of data that we let out there that we make public that is just more ammunition for a criminal to use against us to open new accounts under our names or to take over existing accounts that we're responsible for. So, you know, the more obscure you are with account information, the better off you are in the long run.
Joining us on the show is security analyst and author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity Was Stolen, Robert Siciliano. Again, for more information, go to his website, robertsiciliano.com. What's your thoughts on social media, Robert? I feel you're going to have some thoughts on that, some strong thoughts.
So social media is today what, you know, back in the day, like the KGB was, you know, back in the 50s and 60s with the Cold War. We were all concerned about, you know, Russian criminals and Russian agents infiltrating and being the mole on the inside of the organization, you know, infiltrating the government and the corporation. Today, the mole on the inside is us and it's social media. We're giving away all the data. We're giving away everything the bad guy needs to become us, to take over our existing accounts, to get access to our friends, our families, our employees, our employers, where we live, where we vacation, where we are, and where we aren't. And that's a problem. We're exposing way too much in that regard. And if people talk about wanting their privacy, but then they give out all this information about them and where they are and so forth, privacy at this point essentially has been decimated as a result of social media. media and other ways in which we expose it. All that being said, keeping in mind that, you know, at any given point in time, somebody who you may not want to watch may be watching, paying unwanted attention, and gathering and taking notes of, you know, what it is that you're doing and who you're with and, you know, information about you. And one big risk about that is, for example, when you go to reset a password on a particular account, like if you forget the password, you often click a link that requires you to answer all kinds of knowledge-based questions. And the answer to those knowledge-based questions may eventually get you your password or get you a new password. And the answers to those knowledge-based questions can often be found on the web via social media. For example, Sarah Palin, that's how her email, her Yahoo account was hacked. Bad guy just hit the forget password link and went ahead and answered, you know, who her high school sweetheart was, where she met him, where she likes to vacation, and so on and so forth. And eventually, you know, hacked her Yahoo account.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's crazy. Well, that's good. Yeah. Very good to know. And, you know, for people out there right now that are listening to this, if you suspect someone has stolen your identity, what is the first step to do, and where do you go? What do you do?
So very first thing is to contact the credit bureaus, and with the credit bureaus, you initiate a well, this is all in regards to new account fraud. So if it's new account fraud where they open up new accounts under your name, you want to basically lock down your social as it appears on your credit report. So it's your credit report that has been essentially compromised when somebody opens up like a new line of credit, they get a new credit card, they get a new mobile phone, and you want to get a fraud alert. A fraud alert will alert a creditor that your identity could have potentially been compromised. And I think in Canada, the option to get a credit freeze may exist. I know in the States it does. And a credit freeze basically locks down your credit so that nobody can open up any new accounts under your name at all. That's to prevent new account fraud. As far as any other forms of account takeover, you know, credit cards compromised and so forth, bank account compromise. You always want to contact the organization responsible for that account and go through their process to restore your good name, to basically reset the clock to make you whole again. And every organization has their own way of doing things.
Is identity theft, you know, something that can be easily avoided?
Well, as long as you have proper systems in place, for example, I work with McAfee, and of course we encourage antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-phishing, and a firewall. As long as you have that on your devices, including your mobile devices, along with updating your operating systems, critical security patches, making sure you have protected Wi-Fi, and protected Wi-Fi means, you know, your wireless connection to the internet at home or at the office or when you're out and about is protected. One program you can get is called Hotspot Shield. It's a free VPN, virtual private network, that you can use on any wireless device, Android, iPhone, a laptop, to connect to the internet, basically protecting your wireless connection. Again, it's called Hotspot Shield. Again, it's free. Check that out online. You want to just do all have all these systems in place, layers of protection, to make it that much more difficult for the bad guy to choose you as their next target.
Okay, and what's the one thing you want to put in our heads right now, you know, as we head out into the world again tomorrow? Like, what is the one thing that we really need to be aware of?
Certainly, you know, fundamentally, it's up your security intelligence. Like, this has been a great opportunity for your listeners to get the fundamentals down. And if you exercise the fundamentals and every day you're conscious of your security, knowing that, you know, there always has been, is, and always will be this criminal element out there, and they're always looking for an opportunity, and you have all these systems in place to prevent them from choosing you, then you're going to be in that much better shape.
Robert, you're awesome. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
That was security analyst Robert Siciliano. Again, for more information on his book and more tips on safeguarding your identity, check out his website, robertsiciliano.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
The concert experience is one that can't be beat. We all love being amongst a crowd of like-minded fans to see our favorite artist, Janet Jackson. There is, however, an alternative that's quickly becoming more popular as our connected world becomes increasingly sophisticated. The streaming concert, watching from the comfort of your own home, is not such a crazy idea. To tell us all about this is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So I subliminally put in my Janet Jackson because I want everybody to still love Janet.
Of course.
So how is money actually first explain the streaming concert. So is it like a channel that you're watching, or is it like a stream?
Yeah, it's a stream, but I mean, it can be anywhere. Like right now, what's happening this month actually is the iTunes concert, of course.
Okay.
Which is fantastic. It goes on every night. There's different artists and major artists. I mean, there's been Elton John. Lady Gaga was the first act. Katy Perry is closing it. So it's you know, top billed artists. But the cool thing about it is you get to see them from your own home.
Wow. Which a lot of people now have these 55-inch, 60-inch TV screens anyways, so...
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the fun of it. I mean, it's never the same thing as going to a show. That's the first thing, and foremost. This is in no way, you know, a way to sort of replace the idea of going to a concert. Mm-hmm. However, this is a fun thing to do if you do want to check somebody out, especially if they're not even playing in your town.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I have to bring up the Janet thing for just a sec because I, for example, the Velvet Rope Tour, which I think you said you saw here as well in Montreal.
Yes.
So I went to see it four times. I saw it twice in Detroit. I saw it once in Toronto. I saw it once in Montreal. And obviously, we all know I'm a Janet fanatic, so that's its own thing. But being just in those different cities, like the venues and just the difference, and like there is magic in the air when you go see a concert.
And then,
but it's funny thing is she actually did release that concert series as a DVD, so I obviously got that as well. And it's funny because when I watch the DVD, which I actually haven't done in a while, but it takes me right back to certain moments of where I was at that concert.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. So I get what you're saying. I mean, you do get the vibe from watching it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you absolutely do.
And how much money is being made, or how is money being made off of these types of gigs?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's kind of like it's kind of offshoot revenue, because there's two things, okay? Like, first of all, there are companies that actually put on shows for you. They do a stream from your house.
Okay.
There's a thing called You Stage It, and Stage It has like – there are a whole bunch of artists that have sort of profiles up there, and if there's someone that you like, you can pay to see one of their shows, and basically they go for a goal, and you know, you can put in, it's usually like $10 or somewhere around there, and fans of that person can watch them perform from a super intimate venue. But as far as money being made, I mean, there's a lot of sort of offshoot revenue, because what happens is, you know, you might wind up buying an album or something. Like I actually watched some of Lady Gaga's show from the first iTunes concert, and I'm not that much of a Lady Gaga fan, but it was still an opportunity to see her without, first of all, paying $200 to go see her in a 20,000 seat venue, and, you know, having to go because I'm not, again, like I said, I'm not that big of a fan. So the cool thing is I get to watch. But if I did, you know, if I was so inclined afterwards, I mean, you go out and you buy an album.
Yeah. And it's funny because I feel like this would be something I would do to check out maybe an artist that I'm, like you said, that you're not so into, or you're just learning about and you don't want to drop like $100 on or whatever.
Yeah.
Yet. I think that's awesome. I think that's a really good sort of idea. And would you say that the streaming, you know, these streaming gigs are, you know, we sort of talked about being there, but do you think in the grand scheme, it's going to be more important to watch these things as a stream as opposed to being there?
Well, I don't think it'll be more important, because I think people will always love going to gigs, mm-hmm. but I think it's important just for awareness of things, because a lot of times, I mean, if a band is touring that you like and they're touring in Europe and you can't see them here necessarily, it's kind of cool that you can watch them on your TV.
Right. Okay.
And so it's important from a sort of promotional standpoint.
And who's footing the big bill, I guess, on all of this?
Well, the biggest ones, obviously, you can guess, are Apple and Google. And I'll tell you why. Because Apple has their, you know, their Apple TV, which has an app built into it to watch the iTunes concerts.
Okay.
So you basically just have to turn it on. You can watch any of them on your TV. Okay. You can watch it on your phone or iPad as well. But I mean, you can put it on your TV if you have an Apple TV. And as far as Google goes, they do a lot of streams, like during Coachella, which is massive. They do a lot of streams so you can watch it from home, basically.
Oh.
And a lot of people say, oh, you know, is it like cannibalizing the sort of concert business? But it's not, because I'm not going to spend thousands of dollars to go to Coachella.
Right.
Yep. So the fact of the matter is, I mean, you can watch it. You can watch bits of it, at least on YouTube. And, you know, why not?
And I like the idea of watching something like Coachella, because, see, I know a lot of people like going to festivals. I don't know that I would.
Right.
Been to a couple of them, and it's like either rip-roaring hot, and you know what I mean? Like, and then there's thousands of people, and you don't really want to ever use the washroom facilities. Like, it's just, so I would, but there's always great acts there, like Coachella, like, or the iHeart Radio Fest. Like,
yeah, exactly.
All of those ones. Like, I would love to go see some of these things, because there's so many great acts that are on the same bill. But I don't want to stand there for 16 hours, you know?
That's the thing, waiting to see somebody that you happen to like who's taking the stage at 2 a.m., right?
Exactly, exactly. And what's in it for the artist, like a Lady Gaga, like a Katy Perry?
Well, I mean, it really has a lot to do with just awareness, right? And I mean, it's the same thing for the people putting on the shows, because going back to Coachella, how many people do you think went to it last year?
No clue.
Like a guess, 80,000 people.
Really?
Okay, so 80,000 people went to Coachella, right?
Wow.
How many people do you think watched it virtually on YouTube? How many do you think streamed it?
I'm going to say 2 million.
Yeah, 4 million.
Nice.
So that's the thing. I mean, it's like, it's great that, you know, we're always aware that people are playing at these gigs, but you can't always go there, because first of all, you're talking about airfare. It's not just a question of going down the street to a gig.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's great for the artist, because it's massive exposure, and it's great for the event itself, because look, we're talking about Coachella. Neither of us have ever been to it.
Exactly. one time, Patrick, one time.
One of these days.
So in the grand scheme then, like, what would you, are you into this whole idea then? Like, you think, like, this is here to stay?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I think I've watched quite a bit of stuff as it is already. Over the last couple of years, they've been doing the iTunes Festival. There's only – where it's happening this year is like 3,200 seats, I think. It's a place called the Roundhouse.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, you're getting to see like pretty major acts up close, and you can even watch the shows after they're done. It's a pretty great thing for a music fan.
That's awesome. Well, Patrick, thank you as always for this.
Thank you.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. You can learn more about him on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, and also make sure to follow him on Twitter @getpatrick.
kellyalexandershow.com.
We all have our own set of aches and pains, but many of us suffer through them on a day-to-day basis. One type of alternative medicine which seems to be helping many people overcome their chronic aches and pains is acupuncture. Joining me today is the founder of the Integrative Health Studio in New York City and Chicago, and is also a pioneering doctor of acupuncture, Dr. Ed LaMadrid. Dr. Ed, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So, Dr. Ed, can we start off just sort of generally talking about acupuncture? Can you explain how it works? Because I think a lot of people just picture needles and then they freak out.
Well, so, and that's kind of a common occurrence, but the interesting thing is that once they get acupuncture, once they try it out for the first time, they're usually converted. Because, you know, a couple of myths that I debunk with a lot of people is, number one, people think that it's painful, and it actually isn't. Depending on where the needles are placed, you know, many people will report feeling nothing at all or maybe a slight pinch. The thing about the needles that we use, they are stainless steel, and a lot thinner than the hypodermic needles that, you know, we get when we go for our flu shot. And everyone knows what kind of sting that is and how sore your shoulder is after you get your flu shot. This doesn't have the same reaction.
Can you explain how the needles don't hurt? Because I'm fortunate that I've had acupuncture. I've been doing it, I guess, for the last probably year and a half now, 2 years. And it just, like, you really don't feel anything except for maybe like a little prick, depending on what part of the body that they need to sort of access.
Yep. Well, so the easy answer to that is that the needles are much thinner. The other thing, remember, for acupuncture needles is that they're a lot smoother. And so they're really designed to go into the skin without kind of ripping the skin open. Like a hypodermic needle is really designed to do that. It's designed to basically make a tunnel so that medication can kind of flow through.
Mm-hmm.
Acupuncture needles are solid. And so basically the skin just kind of parts. And that's why the sensation is very different. And for most people, it's not painful at all.
Can you explain what the needles are actually doing? Because I think, again, a lot of people are like, well, why are you sticking needles in me and how is that going to help?
So you have to look at it this way. So we have an energy system in the body, and at certain points in the body, the energy comes very close to the surface of the skin. These are the acupuncture points that we use. Basically, these are like traffic signals in the body. And so they kind of regulate the flow of energy throughout the body. And if we use the analogy of a car, you know, you've got your electrical system in the car, and you know that if the wiring is off a little bit, you know that that maintenance light is going to go off on your dashboard, is not going to click off, and, you know, it tells you that you need to kind of look at something. So what the acupuncture needle does is it accesses the energy of the body at specific points. And depending on what's going on with that person, the needle will actually do the change. So in other words, so there are three things that we look at. People could come in with not enough energy, you know, and we've all felt that, you know, we're exhausted, we're tired. Another thing could be people having too much energy. We've seen some of those people too. They're a little bit bouncing off the walls and they're not even on coffee. And then we've got kind of a more common pattern, which is stagnation. So we have enough energy, but it's stuck at certain points in the body. And that's basically a traffic jam. Think about when you're in a traffic jam, what happens? If you're on a time schedule, you start getting a little upset. Maybe you start getting a little overheated. And so that happens in the body, and that happens to our emotions when we become stagnated. So the needle can actually bring in some more energy or sedate or slow down energy that's too fast or too excessive. And in the cases where it's stagnated and stuck, actually releases it.
That's amazing. And when you get a treatment, how long does it take to sort of start activating? Does it activate right away? Does it take 24 hours? Like, how does that work?
Well, the interesting thing is that it does activate right away. Now, the way people will feel it might be a little bit different. So I've had patients with different pain syndromes, and they walk out after one session pain-free. For other patients, depending on how long they've had the symptoms, you know, they may come in and say, "Doc, my pain is at a level 10. But after the treatment, it's down to a 2 or a 3, which is pretty profound when you think about it, in one session. And then again, you have to consider how old the patient is, how long they've had the condition. So for some people, they get immediate results. For other people, it needs to kind of build over a period of time.
Can you talk about what types of pain that you can help alleviate and you know, what types of problems and stuff that you can help?
Sure. Well, one of the main things that acupuncture has been thoroughly researched is just all kinds of musculoskeletal pain. So it could be the pain from a stomach ache, could be the pain from a headache. And headaches, acupuncture is great for all kinds, you know, starting out with like tension headaches, food headaches, I forgot to drink coffee headache, or even migraine headaches. And then we start getting into other areas of pain like osteoarthritis. There were actually a couple of great studies that came out that showed acupuncture was more effective in treating knee pain and shoulder pain than some of the other treatments that are widely available. Back pain is a primary thing that people will go to for acupuncture. And then also emotional pain, which is a lot of people are not aware of, but acupuncture has been very effective in treating depression, anxiety, you know, all those kind of really emotionally painful situations.
Is it true that there are lots of organs in your body that carry emotion and that acupuncture can help deal with?
That's an interesting question. And so according to traditional Chinese medicine, the answer is yes. So we deal with a theory called the five-element theory in Chinese medicine. And what that is that there are five major emotions that we all deal with. There are five major tastes. They're all different things. And when we get back to the emotions, the thing about the emotions is that we as people need to experience all the emotions equally. That's a very balanced lifestyle. That's a very balanced approach. So things like joy, of course, we would think, of course, who wouldn't want more joy? But then also one of the emotions is also anger. And a lot of people might think, oh, well, anger is bad. And actually, traditional Chinese medicine says that's not true. There's always a place for anger, and it's the appropriate release or expression of anger. So when people kind of hold on to anger and they don't get to express it, that's when it becomes pathological. That's when it can cause problems later on. But, you know, if you're upset about something, there's a way to kind of express it in a better way, in a healthier way. And the other emotions would be worry, grief, and fear. And so organs in the body are home to those emotions, according to Chinese medicine. So if I have someone who's coming in and they're very fearful, the kidneys are actually the organs in Chinese medicine that hold the energy of fear. And so I might treat the kidneys or treat the kidney channel in order to deal with that fearful situation that the patient's dealing with.
That's amazing. I think it's just so wonderful. And, you know, I will freely admit, before I started acupuncture, I actually went to acupuncture as a last resort about, like mm-hmm. I said, about a year and a half ago, because my traditional GP, who I love very much, but I had wrist problems. Like all of a sudden, my wrists just started to ache. And I'm a very active person. I've been in karate since I was 6 years old. And his answer to me was, well, you've been doing, you know, karate for years and years and years. And it's like chronic overuse and abuse. And you're just going to have to deal with this. And I was like, I don't want to deal with this. And then it was a friend of mine that said, you know, try acupuncture. And I went to see her right away, this girl that I was recommended to go see. And she's still my acupuncturist now. And she's a rock star. And she actually told me, she's like, we're going to get this. And it was just so wonderful, the compassion that she showed to me. And then she did get it. Like, it took a little bit longer because I, for whatever reason, like, I guess I'd been dealing with the situation for probably about 7 or 8 months at that point. And so it took more. She had expected sort of about 4 sessions for it to be dealt with. It took about 10 or 11. But I'm great today. Like, I would say that one wrist is completely healed and the other one is at about 98%.
And that's also kind of within the normal range of expectation. I mean, when we look at a repetitive stress syndrome, it depends on how badly damaged the tendons and the ligaments are and overstretched. And so that'll also dictate how long the treatment is gonna last for. But ultimately, you know, and you're a great testament of that. You've seen results and you're feeling much better.
What do you say to people who are afraid of it? Because again, like, a lot of people just freak out over the needle thing. But I think a lot of people, apart from the needles, like, they just, it's like they won't accept. Like, I was open to the experience. And I feel like some people are like, this is like, you know, mumbo jumbo. It's not going to work. Like, what kind of mindset do you need people to be in, Dr. Lamadrid?
Well, so that's an interesting comment. And I come across that all the time. I get the naysayers. I get not only people that are afraid of the needles, because that we can kind of get through. But if you're very kind of adamant, and you don't even have to believe in acupuncture for it to work. So let me share with you a story that was just released in the news yesterday. There's a tiger in Israel that has a chronic ear infection, and for the past year, and has not responded to any of kind of the standard care, standard antibiotics or anything like that. They're now giving the tiger acupuncture.
Wow.
Which is a big thing. And now that tiger will respond very quickly, because the tiger doesn't have any belief system, positive or negative, regarding the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so animals are a great resource that kind of show us that this medicine works whether you believe in it or not.
That's amazing. Now, can you talk to us a little bit about, like, cupping? Because I know that that's something that is used, like, they've used that on me. Can you explain what cupping is, Dr. Lamadrid?
So cupping is great. I actually did a segment on television just recently, and a lot of celebrities have kind of embraced it as the new trendy treatment. The thing is that it's been around for thousands of years, first off, and it's not entirely an Asian modality. It was being done in Egypt. It went into Greece, went into China. And so I have a lot of patients from Russia, from Poland, that tell me, oh yeah, my grandmother used to put cups on my back when I had a cold. And that's one of the reasons why we would use cupping. It actually stimulates the immune system. So if you, let's say every fall you catch a cold,
mm-hmm.
you start getting cupping in August and September, you will not catch a cold for the rest of the season. And they've actually proven this with blood tests. They've actually shown that as soon as the cups are administered, white blood cells start getting produced very quickly and the immune system is boosted.
And how many sessions would you have to do that, Dr. Lamadrid? Let's just say, for that example, like, you start in August, do you do like a few or how many?
Well, so if you're in relatively good health, usually one or two treatments is all it takes
okay.
to boost your immune system. Now, if you're chronically sick, then you may need a couple more and spaced out a little bit more, so maybe once a month to kind of maintain your level of immunity.
That's fantastic. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is acupuncturist Dr. Ed LaMadrid. For more information, make sure to check him out on his website, www.edlamadrid.com. Can you explain, we talked a little bit about some of the things that you can help with. I wanted to go back to neck and head pain, because I think a lot of people, and probably lower back pain as well, that seems to be what a lot of people suffer from. Again, is it the same principle where you're you know, using the needles to draw attention to those areas and that's what's getting you through? Because I know my acupuncturist, for example, had mentioned to me that she often gets referred by doctors to treat migraine sufferers.
Mm-hmm. And that's usually, I mean, just to kind of backtrack on something that you had said before, a lot of our patients come in as kind of the last resort. They've done the entire contemporary medicine, you know, scope. They've done the medication. And maybe they're one step away from surgery, and they want to try one more thing. And if they have a progressive physician, they'll recommend trying acupuncture.
Have you had difficulties, Dr. LaMadrid, with traditional, you know, GPs, like general doctors? Because I know, like, I've been around enough of them where, like you said, some of them are progressive and are open to it, and then others are like, it's mumbo jumbo.
Well, yes. Depending on where. If you're walking around in California, you will probably, you walk two blocks and you'll probably bump into two or three acupuncturists. They're just all over the place. And on the West Coast, there's a lot more acceptance. Acupuncture is actually in the hospitals in California, which
oh, wow.
is great. In New York, it's starting to get there on the East Coast. And in the Midwest, definitely some challenges with some of the more conservative physicians. And so, yes, I come across that. And one of the ways that I deal with that is I show them the research. You know, and the research doesn't lie at that point. And this is clinical, randomized, you know, it's research that's done to the highest standards of scientific research. And then they can't say anything at that point. And so many times they'll refer their patients with kind of the comment like, I don't know how it works, but research says it works, so go ahead and try it. And so my patients come.
Can you explain as well, Dr. LaMadrid, I'd heard about the change of season treatments. Can you explain what that is?
So let me go back to something that I said earlier. We talk about the five element theory in Chinese medicine. And so within that theory, there are five seasons. And for each season is kind of tied into a specific organ. And when that season comes along, the body is going to be more susceptible if that organ is not strong enough to those diseases. So the fall is one of the primary ones. And the fall correlates with the element of metal, which correlates with the organs of the lungs. So one of the most common conditions we see in the fall are bronchitis affecting the lungs. So let me share with you an historical story about acupuncture physicians. Back then, they used to travel from village to village as preventative medicine. So they would go into a village in anticipation for the season, and they would treat everybody in the village to basically boost their immune system for the coming seasonal diseases. And basically, if anyone got sick, they'd probably be hearing from the emperor at that point. They'd get into trouble. So Chinese medicine really developed the thought of preventative medicine, not just screening, which is what we have now, but actually doing a treatment to prevent a future condition from happening.
That is just awesome. Dr. LaMadrid, what would you like to leave my listeners with as a sort of a parting thought about acupuncture?
Well, one of my missions really is to inform people and to give people choices in their medical health care. You know, contemporary medicine has a lot to offer, but I think in partnership with Asian medicine, you've got an amazing combination for people. And the other thing that I would add is that acupuncture is so good with many of our chronic problems that Western medicine just can't deal with, things like headaches, things that may not be life-threatening but are annoying, and annoying to the point where we're now taking daily medication just to kind of control it when, you know, a couple of sessions of acupuncture could take care of it permanently. So things like the aches and pains that we deal with, things with stiffness, things with low energy, bad sleep, chronic headaches, these are things that could be addressed very quickly and effectively with acupuncture and Chinese medicine.
Dr. Ed Lemadrid, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly. Glad to be on the show.
That was acupuncturist again, Dr. Ed Lemadrid. Make sure to check him out on his website for more tips and information. Very simple, edlemadrid.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for taking the time to join us on our look back at the year that was on the Kelly Alexander Show. We really appreciate your time and support of our show. Happy New Year. We wish you health, happiness, and success for 2014. And I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from François de La Rochefoucauld. When work, commitment, and pleasure all become one, and you reach that deep well where passion lives, nothing is impossible. Have a great week. Thanks for hanging out. Make sure to check us out on social media at K Alexander Show, on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course on YouTube, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Take care. We'll talk soon.